Coming up on today's BMW Motorrad Ride and Talk podcast, helmet design, manufacturing, and the people that work to make it happen. Take a listen. Over the years, I've had the privilege of riding BMW motorcycles all over the world. And the one thing I've come away with is that the only thing more extraordinary than the ride are the people you meet along the way. These are their stories. My name is Sean Thomas, and this is BMW Motorrad's Ride and Talk.
The big advantage that we have here is that I can get in contact or involve any specialists, even of the automotive department. You have a lot of great people here, young people, older people, skilled people. When you realize to combine different characters, it's much more than just one plus one. And that's our advantage here.
Many years ago, I was taken on a tour of a facility that manufactures BMW helmets, hosted by Udo Wattendorf, part of the helmet development team at BMW. Throughout the day, Udo showed us how BMW helmets are designed, tested, and built. This was easily one of the most fascinating professional experiences I've ever had, not the least of which due to the knowledge and enthusiasm radiated by Udo. Today, Udo remains a key developer of helmets at BMW, and just like so many years ago, he is incredibly knowledgeable, well-spoken, and enthusiastic. My producer, Louise Powers, and I sat down with Udo in Munich to discuss helmet design, the materials used, and the importance of the people that bring concepts to reality.
All right, I have a story for you, okay?
Okay.
I was in Mongolia, and we were riding bikes. This was for the GS Trophy, and I had the GS Carbon helmet on. And it was a really hot day. And we got stuck at a checkpoint.
Ah.
And we had to wait. And we waited for a long time. And I was sitting on the bike and I was so tired. And it was hot. And I leaned my head forward. And I never noticed until that moment that the peak of my GS Carbon helmet mated perfectly with the windscreen cutout on the GS. Like when I leaned my head forward, there was a perfect seam between the two. And I go, that cannot be an accident. That must have been. And it got me thinking about this incredible process of design that goes into making a helmet.
Yeah.
And it is such a huge deal, starting way back with a piece of paper and an idea. Can you tell us where it goes from there?
Yeah. So, but this was really, really a long-term process because the peak for a helmet is the most aerodynamically, it's a nightmare.
Right. Because everybody
it's,
that wears...
It's just like, yeah. Well, the peak is just disturbing.
Yeah.
Everybody that rides an adventure bike on the highway with a dual sport helmet knows that feeling of how
it's just a nightmare. So you have to guarantee maximum aerodynamic efficiency.
Mm-hmm. And this is so interesting because so many manufacturers now, they just make the peak shorter.
No.
Fine. But then it doesn't do its job when it's protecting you from the sun.
That's it. That's it. Yeah. And it's an enormous force and pressure by wind, driving on the peak.
Yeah.
So it has to be stable somehow. It may not have any vibrations due to the wind. And so this was really, really complex. And we just tried out because at some point you have to try out. You have to print on the 3D printer. Mm-hmm. You have to print the peaks and just test them on the road. And we are quite lucky here. We can use any bike that we want.
Yeah.
When we have the helmet here as a prototype helmet and you just go out on the road, I have everything that I need, all the suits, gloves. I have everything here.
Yeah.
It's over there. And I just take my stuff and I just go out with a bike for 1 or 2 hours and test the helmet.
Sure.
Or to a colleague, let's go together to share our impressions. And we just test it on the road. And
test the helmet.
No fun at all.
No fun at all.
So it obviously we just stay out for 2 hours or 3 hours or 4 hours when we get lost, when we just lost by discussion and ideas and just this kind of spin it. I feel, but this is better. Oh, no. But do you feel this rumor? Ah, okay. And the next time I will have a look on this rumor and just testing it.
Yeah.
And we are quite happy here in Germany because when we test the peak, we go full throttle.
Sure.
It doesn't make sense. Yeah. Okay, 120, this is okay.
Yeah.
What happens at 180? What happens at 200, 205, 210 on the GS, on the Autobahn?
Yeah.
We just go. And of course, it's like that. But anyway, we just have to test the helmet at in any situation.
It's fascinating to look at some of your specs where you see the wind carrying over the windscreen of the bike, mm-hmm. and then creating the little vortex between the bike and the rider, and how things like the peak and the vents are all designed to carry air through the helmet. The way that air interacts with a GS. It's all integrated and married together.
We do a lot of investigation in simulation, in all the virtual simulation for aerodynamics, and together with a bike.
Yeah. Yep.
Of course, together with a bike that the helmet is meant to be. I'm not native speaking English, but you understand what I mean.
Yes.
Yeah. The GS helmet with the GS bike.
Yeah. That's it. And various GS versions.
Sure,
of course. Smaller one and the bigger one and the adventure and everything like that. Yeah. Because their enormous influence, of course, is the windshield.
Mm.
But the helmet has to work in any conditions.
Sure, and different size riders too.
That's it.
I mean, just the four
That's
of us sitting
absolutely
here.
Right. Absolutely right. We investigate in because we have the big advantage that we have here is that I can get in contact or involve any specialists, even of the automotive department. This is an enormous advantage. You have a lot of great people here. Young people, older people, skilled people. It's super nice here. This is just Disneyland for a developer here.
Yeah.
Yeah, the wind gallery people, absolutely experts. And of course, if you maybe or very often totally different characters, but when you listen to people and you listen to them by wanting to hear their opinion, you have won. If you want to discuss with these people and really want to profit of their knowledge, and it's just involving people with their skills, this gives you an enormous advantage. And when you realize to combine different characters, it's much more than just one plus one. And that's our advantage here. We have the simulation people of the car, of the automotive development. We have all the wind galleries that we can use.
Yeah.
And these are wind galleries that you can get in with all the bike.
Yeah.
At a very early state, we sit on the bike in the wind gallery with a printed helmet on it, on the bike, on a GS or whatever you want, just to test the helmet under various conditions in a very, very early stage.
When we first met, the System 7 helmet was just at the final stages of development. And you had this articulating element, you know, where the helmet would lift up, but it wouldn't just lift up on a single hinge.
Yeah.
It would go up and then over and back and re-click into an upright position, which was so interesting. I had never seen its equal ever.
Well, we did not stop this kinematics with the System 7 helmet. We already had it with the System 6 helmet. But the new was that we combined it with a detachable chin part.
Yeah.
So the classical movement, we already knew how this works.
Yeah.
This is not just a rotation movement in one axis. It's a kinematic with two different axes, and it's just a lever mechanism that's the chin part comes down when it's in the uplifted position.
And this is something that Louise is always yelling at students about when we teach, is they put their helmets in the upright position and then they ride with it up and they hit a bump and it comes down a little bit into their eyes.
Exactly. There are several advantages of the disadvantages that the movement and the kinematics and the technical solution is very complex. So it's not done just by, okay, I try it and then go. It's not like that. It's just trying because the shapes get into conflict. The shell geometry gets into conflict with the movement. And so you have to define right from the start with the design department this kind of technology. You cannot just, at the end of the design process, you cannot say, okay, I will, now I need a chin mechanism that's working like that.
Yeah.
You have to introduce this mechanism right from the start and discuss all the conflict zones with the design department, and they have to design the surfaces around this technology.
Mm. And that's assuming that you're doing a single shape helmet, but you're not, because System 7 comes in different sizes.
Yes, of course, but it's always like that. We have two different helmet sizes. Mm-hmm. The smaller one that goes up to 59, mm-hmm. size 59, and then the bigger one that starts at 60. Mm-hmm. Up to the end of the range.
Right. So on the one hand, the helmet size shape is getting bigger, which means the mechanics have to get bigger, but the visor stays the same. So you're having to make some parts of it bigger, but some parts stay the same, and they all have to meet together seamlessly.
Great, John. You're totally right at this point, because we use two helmet shells, mm-hmm. but one visor.
Yeah. All of this, and you still have hair. I don't have hair, and I don't do this. Now, it was 2015, I was invited to Italy mm-hmm. to see the manufacturing, and I'm stricken when we get there at how the people that work there responded to you. They came up and gave you big hugs, and they were showing you pictures of their kids.
Yeah.
And it was really special, and I came to understand that there was a bit of background about that. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. It's a bit like I told you before, when you reach the people by heart and by, I don't know the English expression, I'm very sorry, by Wertschätzung. It's not a value in terms of money, but it's just when you really get in contact with the people, you combine yourself with these people. Mm. And we had, during development time, it's a very strong time of growing together.
Yeah.
And this is somehow even a combination of various people.
Mm.
And you get very close somehow.
Yeah.
And when I do development, I very often ask the workers down in the production lines mm-hmm. about their opinion.
Mm.
Because they are the first people and the experts of assembling the helmet. And when it comes to production to the helmet, they are the first people that tell you this is not working well. Virtually, in the CAD, it works perfectly.
Sure.
But the people with the right understanding are the people down there in the production lines.
Sure.
And they all know me by name, of course, because we got together. We combined ourselves somehow. That was just the situation, and that's why.
Yeah.
We hugged when we meet, mm-hmm. and it's in these days it's the same. We hug when we meet in Italy, and it never happened to me in any other production.
Mm.
I don't know where this comes from, but it was because of this story.
Yeah, we hug in America too.
especially
Sean.
We don't have this tradition.
What was fascinating for me being at that factory was that, you know, I've never seen a helmet manufactured. So I assumed it was just, you know, a bunch of materials are put into a machine and it stamps out a helmet and that's done. And it's so involved and so precise and so many steps. Mm-hmm. Each step is a human hand touching that helmet and working it through.
Exactly. That's the main issue. Mm. It's 95% manual work.
Yeah.
And you absolutely depend on the enthusiasm and the trustability of these people.
Yeah.
And it can be done in various ways.
Mm.
And that's why it's so important that the people, they identify themselves with the product.
Yeah.
And it's always very, very nice when you realize how the people are involved in your product.
Hmm.
When I pass by people of production line, they just raise up their hand and say, Udo, come here.
Yeah.
I just want to show you something.
Hmm.
I am not the employee.
Sure.
But they just want to show you something because they do it with their heart.
Hmm.
This makes the difference.
You come from a background of clearly very diverse, but your claim to fame to start with, I think, was carbon fiber, and your understanding of it and how to manipulate it and how it's applied to the helmet is really interesting, because it's carbon in a look and layout that is different than any other helmet I've ever seen. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. You have different materials, mm-hmm. As carbon fiber, And you have the woven material, the classical woven material that we all know.
And we typically will see, like any carbon will be clear-coated so you can see the weave of the carbon. But but your carbon is not like this.
It's not like that. Yeah. It's the classical 3K or 6K fiber or even 12K fiber. It depends on the manufacturer and the development of the shell, how the shell is realized. But and the next step would be a non-crimp fabrics that doesn't make these angulations of the fiber.
So no weaves.
No weaves.
Right.
And up and downs.
Sure.
And the non-crimp fabrics is just a layered material that is sewn together with a polyester thread or something like that.
So because there's no weave, the fibers lay flat against each other.
And that's giving you much more performance. When you elongate a fiber, then this means the first thing that you do is you take out the curves.
Yeah, the weave is...
The weave.
It's a straight line now.
And then it comes to the force of the material, that.
It created a bit of a marketing issue, didn't it? Because the way you lay out the carbon is not terribly visually pleasing. It's much better performance-wise. You have to paint it.
Yeah, you have to paint it. Yeah. With the GS helmet, we used non-crimp fabrics because this was an earlier development.
Yeah, sure.
But with the System 7, I just wanted to go one step beyond the known steps or the known, the classical way to build up a helmet shell. And, of course, the disadvantage is that you don't have visible zones with transparent coating.
So we see them take these pieces of, pre-cut carbon fiber, and there's several of them, and they get put inside this sort of inverted helmet mold, right? And then they sort of get pressure cooked with resin. Is that how it works?
Well, the classical pre-preg process, you build up all the small cuts of the carbon fiber material into the shell. And under pressure, it's cooked in the oven for a certain with a certain cycle.
Yeah,
this is just like you build up the Formula One chassis or something like that. It's the same process. It's absolutely the same. Yeah,
I remember seeing them take the helmet out of the form, bring it over to have, because of course you have now a solid helmet and there's no cutout for the C and all the various bits of holes that go in to mount all the equipment. And they put it inside this machine that used a water cutter.
It's a water jet, yeah.
Yeah. And what was fascinating to me is the helmet sat on this form and it was this huge chunk of steel that the helmet sat on. And there were holes burned through the steel from the water cutter.
Yep.
And it just really shows you, wow, this thing really can cut just a stream of water.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I think the pressure is something around about 1,000 bars or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Of all the processes of the helmet manufacturer, the one that seemed to, that you were so excited to show us that was so fragile was applying the decals on the helmet.
Yeah.
Because they're so fragile.
Yeah, it's... You need a very, very steady hand, and you just put the decal into water, and then you can take out the film, just like that, and put it on the helmet.
Yeah.
And the problem is that you have to get rid of all the wrinkles.
Right.
But the decal in itself is super fragile, so when you press too hard, you just ruin the decal.
Yeah, and it's not on a flat surface
and
either.
You don't have a film that is combining the decal or holding it together.
Yeah.
The decal in itself, it's just sprayed coat.
Mm.
It's just sprayed coat holding together by, I don't know, but there is no film that the decal is applicated on. And then you have to be aware that for the decal process, you have to take the helmet out of the coating process. You have a coating line, and when you have a monocolor helmet, you do the base, send it by hand, then you put it into the coating line, and the helmet shells are painted automatically.
Yeah.
And they just rotate, and they are sprayed, then they are coated automatically. And so you do the two times, you do the base color, and at the end, you do the transparent color. It can be shining or opaque or matte.
Sure.
But when you have the decal process, you have to do the base color
Yeah.
Then take the helmet out of the coating line. Then you applicate the coating.
Right.
Then you, it's not cooking, but drying.
Yeah, sure.
Drying all the decal on the helmet. And then you have to get back the helmet to the coating line for the transparent coating. Mm. So this means all the decals are underneath the transparent coating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What was interesting for me too is that typically when I see a process of manufacturing, we see human hands will touch something and work with something, and then it goes into a machine and the machine sort of refines what they just did. But it was the opposite. You had components go into a machine to get work done, and then human hands would take it out and do fine adjustments to get it just right.
Yeah, you speak of the robot sanding.
Mm.
When it comes to very, very complex 3D shapes and geometries, like we have it in our helmets.
Yeah.
We can find it in our helmets because we don't want to limitate our design.
Yeah.
Just because it's easier in the further process. Mm-hmm. We don't do that. And so you cannot work too much with the robot.
Mm.
And in these, it was an approach of these days, mm-hmm. 8 years ago.
Yeah.
But my feeling is that the work of the robot was more and more reduced. So we could not use the robot more and more.
Yeah.
We tried it on this level, and then we got back to the manual operation process.
Yeah.
Just because it's so precise, the surfaces, and you can ruin a lot by sanding.
Mm-hmm. From the point that you went from deciding it was time to develop a helmet to the point that you have a product in hand that can be sold, mm-hmm. How much time are we talking about here?
3.5 years.
3.5 years.
Yeah, 3.5 years with a lot of investigation. Here, we work together with around about 7 designers.
Mm-hmm.
Right from the beginning of the project, we have at least 7 persons, project people at our partner.
Sure.
Yeah, and at various stages of the development process, you have various people involved in the project. For example, we have had with the System 7 three or four people in the virtual aerodynamic simulation department, automotive department working for us. And just for, let's say, for 4 weeks or 5 weeks or 6 weeks. Then, of course, when we had the prototype helmet in our hands, even 3D print, we worked together with the wind gallery experts. Mm-hmm. We organized the bikes to get in. You have to get the slot for the wind gallery. This is quite challenging because everyone wants to be in the wind gallery. And okay, and so we tested the helmet there, and then it switched from one department to the next one. And but the core team is always the same.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now, you'd mentioned how important it is to integrate the helmet design into the design of the motorcycles. Does that mean that you have a say? Like, can you go to them when they're designing a motorcycle and say, hey, I love the bike, but I need you to make the windscreen a little different because it'll help?
No.
It doesn't work that way.
It's like slaughtering the holy cow. No, you don't have this power. Yeah. You have to get along with the situation.
Sure.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And that's it. No, you have to adapt yourself with your helmet to the situation of the bike or something like this. But that you cannot just drive these people.
Yeah. We in the U.S., we are often at the training department there at BMW Corporate Zonk, and where they teach people how to work on cars. And they have an i3 there that's just the chassis, and it's all carbon fiber. Mm-hmm. And we always walk by it, and I point at it and say, Udo.
Yeah.
That's Udo's design. That's Udo's carbon fiber.
It's not Udo's carbon fiber, but I worked in this department.
No, let's keep it just Udo. Okay. I don't want to memorize all the names of the people.
Udo. Yeah. That's nice.
So, just for reference, we also want to bring up the fact you have been interviewed for Ride and Talk before.
Yes.
And you were on a sabbatical at the time. Yeah.
Yes. After the System 7 project, I was quite exhausted.
Mm.
And because I've been in Italy nearly every week.
Yeah.
And I was, of course, even emotionally, in an emotional way, very, very much involved in the the project. That's just my character. It's just my way of working.
Sure.
And sometimes I wish it would be different, but it is not.
Yeah.
Because it absorbs you enormously.
Yeah. And for those of you listening, at the end of this podcast, we'll give you the episode number so you can listen to
Udo Post. I think it's
Udo Post System 7 Sabbatical.
Yeah, yeah. It's. I think it's not System 7. It was not combined with System 7. It was just Luz de Esperanza in Bolivia, in La Paz.
Yeah.
But it's Ride and Talk, I think, 41, version 31. Yeah.
Yeah. Udo, you're in charge of more than helmets at BMW Motorrad, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Is it okay if we come back again and talk about some of these other products?
Of course.
Just because you're enthusiastic.
I very appreciate this. Of course, you know that. We know since quite a lot of years, and it's always nice to see you, to talk to you, and it's always just nice to get in contact.
Yeah. We'll bring beer next time.
Oh, we have beer. Don't worry about that.
Oh.
It's like bringing water to the lake or to the river, like the Italians say.
Yeah.
You don't have to bring your beer with you. Don't forget about that.
We're coming back.
I think we should.
Many times.
Yeah.
Udo, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with
Thank
us.
Thank you.
It was so
super
awesome.
Nice.
Thank you, brother.
Like always. A big, big hug.
Big hugs. We very much hope you have enjoyed this episode. We want to hear from you, so please rate, comment, and share your thoughts about this podcast. We have many more episodes on the way, so please subscribe, follow along, and share your requests for future episodes of the BMW Motorrad Ride and Talk podcast.